welcome to another episode of They Came From the North, your whatever weekly, bi-weekly, monthly, whenever we feel like it, podcast about directors made by Canadians.
Because that's how we roll.
Yes.
We also roll in the way that saying that's how we roll is a good thing to say every single cast. So
that's because we're streets ahead.
That's better than being streets behind.
This is true.
This is your old Gabriel, and joining me as usual, or mostly usual, we have Andrew Forbes.
I wasn't prepared to be first. Hi.
Steve Power.
Listen to him with me as usual, Steve Power. Bah! You take me for granted, Gabriel Girard.
You'll always be there to comfort us.
And John Mercer.
I'll never forgive you guys for this week's choice. Never.
Yeah, I take all the blame.
Yeah, I've started my own spiral into alcoholic self-destruction.
Our subject this week is Paul Schrader, born in 1946 in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He grew up in the Calvinist faith, and was raised up in the religion's strict beliefs, and didn't see a movie until he was 17 years old.
Wow. That's your cue, John.
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening.
I thought you had a zinger. Didn't see a movie till he was 18.
And still hasn't made one.
Nice save there, Power. Nice save. Twang!
I received a BA from Calvin College with a minor in theology, and then an MA in film studies from UCLA Film School, where he was under Pauline Kael's apprenticeship. And
then he mastered in guilt.
He got an MA in film studies and a BAD in filmmaking.
Let's just get through this bio.
I'm sorry, Gabe.
Under her care, he became a film critic for the Los Angeles Free Press, and even wrote a book comparing Robert Bresson, Yasuhiro Ozu, and Carl Dreyer.
That's some good reading right there.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that his writing on Paul Dreyer was probably the least depressing aspect of his career.
some other filmmakers he cites are, as example, are John Ford, Jean Renoir, Roberto Rossellini, Hitchcock, and Sam Peckinpah. In 1974, he co-wrote the film The Yakuza with his brother Leonard, was directed by Sidney Pollack, and got him some attention, made him then in 1975, he both wrote Obsession for Brian De Palma and Taxi Driver for Martin Scorsese. The success of that movie brought him to write and direct Blue Collar, a comedy, I guess.
A dark comedy.
Made me laugh.
a dark comedy caper about three workers on an automobile chain, starring Yaphet Kotto, Harvey Keitel, and Richard Pryor. With all these egos in place, Paul Schrader had a breakdown and was reconsidering his film career. But he came back in 1979 and did the movie Hardcore, starring George C. Scott and produced by nobody else than John Milius.
I didn't know that.
Yes, sir.
Hardcore.
Sorry. In 1980, he also wrote. I'll note some of his writing credits because I think he's mostly known in the film world as a scriptwriter than as a director. In 1980, he wrote *Raging Bull* again for Scorsese, and also wrote and directed *American Gigolo*, starring Richard Gere.
I believe that was a star-making turn for Richard Gere, was it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think
rolling around in designer
that was pre-Officer and the Gentleman, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think it was just before, yeah.
just before Officer and a Gentleman. And I think that was a pretty big hit and a pretty well-known film at the time, especially due to Blondie's song Call Me, which was used for the credits and as a basis for Giorgio Moroder's score.
Now I'm really sad that I missed it. I love that song.
In 1982, he made the remake of the Val Lewton produced and Turner directed flick Cat People, again featuring a very well-known song by David Bowie and with lots of naked Natasha Kinski. In 1985, he wrote and directed Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters, which earned him a nomination for the Palme d'Or in Cannes. The movie was executive produced by George Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola. In 1986, he wrote the screenplay for The Mosquito Coast, which was directed by Peter Weir. 1987, he made the rock and roll movie Light of Day with Michael J. Fox and Joan Jett. 1988, he made the movie Patty Hearst, which he did not write, and also wrote the screenplay for The Last Temptation of Christ. In 1988, the movie The Comfort of Strangers, which was based on a Errol Pinter screenplay and takes place in Venice, a kind of, I don't know, erotic thriller with Christopher Walken.
Which is not something that inspires a great deal of confidence going in. Erotic thriller starring Christopher Walken.
Well, the stars are actually Rupert Everett and what's her name? Richardson. Natasha, I think, Richardson.
Nevertheless, that phrase should not exist.
Erotic. Anyway.
In 1992, he wrote and directed the movie Light Sleeper with Willem Dafoe about a drug dealer. In 1997, the movie Touch, adapted from an Elmore Leonard novel. 1997, a movie that put him back in the spotlight, Affliction, which got Oscar nominations for Nolte and Coburn, and Coburn won, I think.
Wasn't that Coburn's last movie, I believe?
I believe so. I think he was in retirement before Affliction. Mm.
And there was a lot of to do about him appearing in that, and
basically the story behind Coburn casting is that a lot of people passed on it because they didn't feel intimidating enough to be able to intimidate Nick Nolte, and James Coburn was the only one crazy enough.
He's also the only man alive who could be the father of both Nick Nolte and Willem Dafoe, and like his face. At that age is a perfect combination of the two. It's really creepy.
Intimidate Nick Nolte. Give me that bottle of whiskey.
In 1999, he wrote and directed the movie Forevermind and also wrote Bringing Out the Dead for Martin Scorsese again. 2002, Autofocus, about the life of Bob Crane, Hogan's hero star. In 2005, Dominion, prequel to The Exorcist, which had major problems. He was fired from the movie, and Renny Harlin completely reshot it. We talked about this a bit on the Renny Harlin podcast.
I don't think he was actually fired so much as his version was shelved. Like, he turned it in, and they basically said, yeah, no, we're going to go in a different direction. I think he actually got to finish it first.
I think there was a long, awkward silence after the executive screening of that movie.
Yeah.
Apparently, William Peter Blatty loves it. But then he directed Exorcist III, so what does he know? In 2007, the movie The Walker. 2008, Adam Resurrected. And coming out this year, The Canyons.
Wow.
So, with that said, let's begin with our good. And I'll start with Andrew.
Okay, well, my good for Paul Schrader. I am going to go with Affliction, I think. I started talking about it, so I may as well continue. It's not a perfect movie, by any means, but I enjoyed it quite a bit. I don't think it really earned quite as much acclaim as it got, mostly because of some really on-the-nose narration by Willem Dafoe's character that really, I mean, it does sound like just chunks of the novel by Russell Banks sort of stuck over some of the scenes, and it does a lot of sort of heavy lifting. Well, actually, I should say light lifting, because it was obvious already. It's like it spells out the themes of the movie in a really sort of insulting way, where you're watching it and it's like, oh, I didn't pick up on that. Thanks, Willem. But it's basically the movie, a movie about the son of an alcoholic, abusive, overbearing father. Nick Nolte is the son. James Coburn is the father. And Nick Nolte's character is kind of this, he's the town police officer. But I mean, he basically looks like a vagrant through the whole movie. He's, you know, on top of being the town police officer, he also, you know, plows the streets and, is the crosswalk for the elementary school. So he's by no means a real authority figure in the town.
And he doesn't seem too bright either.
No, and I have to say, like, one of the good things about it is that it doesn't, it's really rare to see a movie about a kind of dim character that doesn't either really condescend or, you know, have them have an uncharacteristic sort of flash of insight. I mean, Nolte plays a perpetually sort of dumb guy, and not in a, you know, I am Sam way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is, he's just your average dumb guy. Like, he's the guy who just, he's never going to make it far in life. And, you know, his problems are largely from another source. And that is sort of the psychological damage he got, you know, from being abused as a kid. But it's sort of refreshing to see a guy, especially in one of these movies. This is one of those sort of like everything keeps going wrong, everybody makes the wrong decision sort of movie. It fits in really well, especially taking place in the winter. It fits in really well with like A Simple Plan or Fargo, even though it's less crime focused. There are no sort of big heists, and the main character isn't actually involved in the crime that takes place in the movie. It's interesting to watch, as far as a sort of study of this guy who essentially could never have had a properly, balanced life. I think he's more or less destined to end sadly.
And I think, I mean, Nolte's performance is really of note in the movie. You can really sense the damage this guy as you see, I mean, he's always walking around like with his shoulder hunched a little, as if the weight of the world is bearing down on him.
But not in a really mannered way. Like, it's not like it's really naturalistic, and you don't feel. On the other hand, James Coburn, I feel, maybe got a bit too much praise, because there are times when he goes a bit over the top. But yeah. In the quieter scenes, he's really good.
Don't you sass me, boy.
Man, candy asses.
thank you, Skeletor.
Well, that's how it sounds. But yeah, it's a flawed movie, but it was very sort of emotionally honest, and I like the fact that it was, you know, he does a bit of sleuthing, and he has a sense that, you know, there are certain forces at play in the town, and maybe a hunting accident wasn't really an accident. And he's sort of sleuthing around and playing private detective. And the movie's smart enough to keep everything messy, and it doesn't resolve itself. And, you know, some things he's flat out wrong about, other things he's right about. And you don't get any neat conclusions to any of the questions he was asking. But it's also, it doesn't end really in a really dissatisfying way. I mean, you sort of feel like it ends the way it should. It's solid.
But that's something I would give to Schrader, that he's good with the ambiguity. You know, that's something that comes out a lot in a lot of his movies.
I think, you know, Schrader's talent, when he's at his best anyway, I think it's getting really good performances, even when the story sort of gets away from him.
Mm-hmm. I think
he, you know, a lot of his movies are kind of messy, and not in a good way, like Affliction. I think a lot of them are sort of messy and they get away from him, but I think it's because he focuses so much attention on the actors and getting really good performances out of them. And you definitely feel that in Affliction.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's the kind of story that lends itself to his type of filmmaking.
Yeah, like it is like observant style, this deliberate pace and all that.
He does seedy really, really well.
Yes.
Yes.
I feel like Affliction is, sometimes he tries too hard for it. You know, it really feels like he's like lifting up a rock and going like, look, everyone, look.
Look at this scum under here.
But, you know, in Affliction...
This is America, film watchers. This is America.
And Affliction doesn't feel like that. It just feels like a sad character study that works really well.
Affliction was also my choice for good.
All right, take it away.
Yeah. I'll be the first to admit I'm not the world's biggest Schrader fan. I don't like vehemently dislike him. I just find that his reach kind of exceeds his grasp.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't really possess the sort of style that adequately matches the darker turns of his writing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Affliction could have been my bad, just the same as my selection for bad might have been my good. Mm-hmm. But you know, I just found, like you're saying, that you got some higher echelon performances in this from Nolte and...
And Sissy Spacek as well is really good.
Yeah.
She's not. It's not a really in-your-face performance, but she's really good in a quieter role.
Yeah, with some of the acting, Affliction rises above. You know, I grow wary of a man on a path of self-destruction movies pretty quickly, unless they're very well acted or have some more meat to them, besides watching an actor waxing during award season.
I have to imagine you're a huge Abel Ferrara fan.
Oh, man. I might surprise you in a future episode. But, no, Affliction, you know, brought both. It's got some good performances, and there's a little bit more than the typical, watch how much I can drink and how dirty I can look on camera.
Well, and one of the things about it is I feel like a lot of those kind of movies are, you know, the audience is just sort of sitting there crossing their arms, kind of going, yes, this is inevitable. He's going to fall apart. And in this one, you get the sense from Nolte that he's actually, in a lot of ways, he's a really good guy, and he's trying really hard. Which is something that you don't see come across very well in some of the other Man on Path of Destruction movies.
No, well, I think that cuts to the core, though, of like Schrader's favorite themes, you know, with the guy who was trying to redeem himself and, you know, was guilt-ridden and stuff and trying to find redemption. That's like the constant theme in his work. Like, you know,
I can't imagine why he and Scorsese get along so well.
Yeah.
I kind of assumed that Schrader must have been Catholic.
well, if you've seen Arco, you remember the scene where like George C. Scott explains the three R's or whatever of the foundations of the Calvinist faith.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Like Affliction's not without its flaws. We already brought up the cheesy narration, but you still could do much worse.
Mm-hmm. I found the flashbacks as well were a little too self-consciously stylized.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, shaky 16mm.
Yeah, but I mean, Schrader does that all the time, man. You remember Mishima?
Mm. Ooh, don't touch Mishima.
it was a little bit of Oliver Stone in the midst of the movie, it felt like to me.
What's wrong with Oliver Stone?
I need grain. I need grain and different film stock. We'll get to that another day, Steve.
It's kind of funny. When I was watching Affliction the past week, I kept going back to the falling off the wagon scene in Warrior, where Nick Nolte turns into Affliction Nick Nolte for about 2 minutes.
I do want to say as well, I mean, part of the reason I liked Affliction so much is I'm a big Nick Nolte fan. Like, I really, really like the guy, and I kind of feel like I really feel sad in these days where he's just the butt of the, like, you know, alcoholic, terrible mugshot jokes?
Do the monologue from Hulk again.
Poisoning humanity's soul. That's my favorite line from Hulk.
Before this turns into the Nick Nolte.
Taking the essence of all things. Sorry.
Before this turns into the Nick Nolte podcast, I'll just say I thought he was awesome in U-Turn, and we can
move on. He was terrifying and hilarious in U-Turn.
That's the smell of a man without scruples.
Fuck it, I want to do a podcast about Nick Nolte.
We should do like a Nolte film fest. Cast.
Do we have to? Do we really have to?
We can do a proper analysis of the difference between Nolte gravel and Wincott gravel.
Oh, there is no contest for Wincott gravel, man. Come on now. Wincott gravel is the gorgeous gravel.
What's that movie did with Sidney Lumet? Like Q&A, I think? He's terrifying in that one, too.
It's the mustache.
All right, Steve, what's your choice for good?
My choice for good is a movie that I think maybe 10 people have seen. If that's probably a very generous estimate. But it was one of the first reviews I ever did for DVD Verdict.
Shameless plug.
Shameless plug. Why not?
Cheap.
But I actually really enjoyed this movie. And to be honest with you, I'd completely forgotten that it was a Paul Schrader film until we were talking about Schrader earlier today on Facebook. And that is Adam Resurrected.
Nice.
Definitely the best performance I ever saw from Jeff Goldblum, without a doubt. Absolutely fantastic movie. It's a movie about...
You haven't seen Mr. Frost, obviously.
Now, it's one of those things that, I mean, and I went back and I reread the review earlier today because, I mean, I wrote it 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 2008, I think it was, or 2009.
Five years ago?
I don't know when it was. It was a while ago. Maybe it was 2011. I can't remember. Anyway, it was one of my first reviews. I don't know how long I've been there. Jesus. But when I went back and like a lot of the thoughts still kind of like I read through it and I was like, yep, definitely. I still pretty much agree with it all. It's at that point in time, there were all of these Holocaust movies. There was The Reader, the Kate Winslet, you know, a courtroom drama, and there was The Boy in the Striped Pajamas. There was like it was kind of this little renaissance of Holocaust movies popping up again, and I'd seen them and thought to myself, you know, like they're empty movies. Like Boy in the Striped Pajamas was just, you know, tug at heartstrings, make the audience cry kind of thing. Oh, the Holocaust was bad, you know. The Reader was, you know, the Holocaust stuff.
Sad to say, it's kind of an easy, lazy subject.
Yes, yeah, and
it's easy to mine emotions out of it.
The Reader was even worse. I mean, the Holocaust stuff for me, for The Reader, felt like window dressing. You know, it felt like it was completely inconsequential to the story. It was just there to make people hate this character so much more or whatever, you know. But with this one, with Adam Resurrected, you know, I got the screener in the mail, and I remember thinking, oh, great, another Holocaust movie, you know. But it's the first movie I've ever seen that really tries to get into the psychology of, like, the Holocaust survivors rather than, you know, focus on the atrocities and focus on, oh, they did this, they're so bad, look, it's a gas chamber, you know, rather than... Like, you just...
Haven't we been hard enough on the Nazis?
not even that. I mean, it's just, you know, there's only so many times you can drive that point home.
Exactly.
You know? Whereas what Adam Resurrected did was it really got into... the individual, instead of focusing on, you know, oh, they killed X number of millions and they had gas chambers and whatever, it got into, this is one person who went through it and was spared, and this is how he feels about it, you know, rather than give, it was a fresh perspective. It was something different. And Schrader being Schrader, it was also severely, severely fucking unpleasant. It was a very dark place, you know, really dark movie. And Goldblum, like, and even the supporting cast. I mean, you had Derek Jacobi, Ayelet Zerrer, the Israeli actress. Willem Dafoe was in there as a really, really mean ass.
How many times has Willem Dafoe worked with Paul Schrader?
A few. Like,
it seems like a match made in heaven, to be honest. But I mean, like, everybody in this movie was, you know, pretty great. I mean, Dafoe's Nazi colonel does kind of devolve into, you know, just movie Nazism a little bit. You know, like, hello, look at me, I'm very, very evil, you know, like, but Goldblum, man, he acts the hell out of this movie. It's worth watching for his performance alone. Like, you know, you talk about actors who really kind of give it their all, but then you get those movies where, an actor goes to just such a different place that it's like, you know, I call them those fearless performances, those really brave performances. And
Goldblum, I think I may look over his IMDb page later and regret saying this and be completely wrong, but it kind of seems like he's a talented actor who hasn't, outside of comedy, hasn't had a lot of opportunities to really sort of go, you know, sort of fire all cylinders, even though he obviously always tries.
Yeah, and I mean, like, you know, it's easy to do that in something like The Fly because it's just so completely out there and off the wall anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, with Adam Resurrected, I mean, this is a dark, very, very dark, unsympathetic character, you know, and Goldblum does so many turns in it. He goes from, you know, this likable grifter to this totally sadistic asshole to this, like, person you can't relate with at all. And, like, you're kind of thinking to yourself, like, how the hell could I possibly identify with this guy? He's just such a mean bastard. And, like, he changes gears so much in the movie that, like, and I think a lot of it, too, is just, you know, the way Schrader plays it all out, the way Schrader directs it, it's so dark and oppressive. And then, like, the final act hits and everything gets tied up a little too neatly. You know, you get this whole Deus Ex Machina cure for Goldblum's mental illness, and then the movie's kind of over, kind of thing. And you're kind of like, wait a minute, you know. But outside of that, it is, you know, you like, it's a great movie to watch just for Goldblum's performance alone. It's really well worth watching. But it is also kind of like, you know, as far as Holocaust stuff and that goes, you want to see some of the twisted psyches that can come out of this kind of human horror.
I'd like to see that remade starring Goldberg.
Starring William Goldberg. But yeah, it was good. I mean, you know, it's worth a look. And as far as Schrader stuff goes, I mean, I've seen about 95% of his body of work, and it's one of the more unpleasant films. But not for the same reasons as something like The Canyons.
It was, you know, I was rewatching a movie today, and that was one I almost went with. And sadly, I went with what is now my ugly. I won't reveal it yet.
Mm.
But I guess I will check that out for sure. When I'm feeling down.
Yeah, no. Don't. Do not watch Adam Resurrected when you're in a state of depression. Never.
While I'm taking apart a razor to clean it.
No, outside of, you know, like, now that I think a little bit more about it, I think I almost think that that Defoe's performance is probably the weakest part of it, because he's the most typical of, you know, he's the most what you would expect.
He can definitely ham it up.
Yeah, and he does, you know. He like, all of Defoe's scenes are black and white flashbacks to World War II, and basically what it is, you know, you get the Nazi camp where they're loading all the Jews onto a train to shift them off to wherever, and, you know, he picks Goldblum out of a crowd with the rest, like, that the rest of his family is in, kind of thing. He takes him out and basically takes him as his personal dog, but he makes him walk around on all fours and bark like a dog and, you know, feeds him out of a dish and that kind of stuff, you know? Like, so that's how he treats him the entire time that... But it's just all in these flashback scenes. It's a little heavy-handed, you know. It is a little heavy-handed. But it's cool. Still, you know, it's worth watching. It is definitely, you know, as far as Schrader goes, I'd probably consider it his most accomplished bit of work.
Thanks. Me being me, I went with his most artsy-fartsy movie.
You dirty guess. Frenchman.
And that is Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters, which is really it's a beautiful and really staggering piece of work. I find it is a hard to approach movie, because I mean
it's a hard to approach subject.
Yeah, it's a very unconventional biopic. Because basically what Schrader and his brother Leonard did is that they divided the movie between quote unquote now moments, where Mishima is going to do and try to do his coup d'etat, and then flashbacks in black and white, and then the third part is sequences taken from his novels, which are shot with really bright colors and in like kind of kabuki sets. And, you know, it doesn't follow the normal progression of a bioflick.
It's more the Naked Lunch approach.
Yeah, it's more the Naked Lunch approach, and the fact that what you see from the novels makes you understand what is going on in Mishima's life, both in the past and the present. You know, it gives you a more complete picture of the guy, even though, like, when I first saw this movie, I wasn't familiar with his story at all. It's beautifully shot. The music by Philip Glass is amazing. And I don't know. I'm running out of adjectives here.
I will say it is definitely the most Criterion-like of his body of work.
Well, Cheeky Steve, it's his only Criterion film.
Well, take that for what it's worth.
Okay. So kind of like Armageddon?
Hmm. There you go. It was an interesting movie for sure. And I guess I have the same problem with Mishima that I have with Naked Lunch. I just, you know... It's one of those things, like the non-linear narrative and the framing devices and just the drastic tone changes and shifts and whatnot. Like, I understand.
I mean, there are some subjects I think where it's defensible to take that approach when you're dealing with. I mean, both of those movies. I mean, you're dealing with an extremely troubled creative mind. And you know, to try to however far you think either movie kind of goes in terms of capturing that, I think you would do a disservice to the subject if you weren't, you know, insanely ambitious.
In its defense, I will say that Mishima is a bit less cryptic than Naked Lunch.
Oh my god, yeah,
because like Naked Lunch, I don't think you can appreciate if you've never read a single word that William Burroughs has written, you know?
I don't think you could appreciate it unless you were William Burroughs' psychiatrist.
Dr. Benway?
Yeah. I don't know. It's one of those things that, you know, like, as an experiment or whatever, fine, okay, nothing wrong with being a little experimental and stuff like that, but... As a film, like as a movie, I think it fails. I really do. I don't consider it to be, you know, it doesn't really, I don't know. It's hard for me to explain without sounding like I'm putting the movie down. And I don't want to put it down because I recognize that it's an ambitious thing and I recognize that Schrader is batshit insane. But, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, I would have liked it more if it were a straight-up traditional narrative. I would have liked it more if it were, you know, if it were just telling us about this guy rather than all this crazy, let's just throw everything at a wall and see what sticks, you know?
You know, I haven't seen the whole thing, so I can't fully comment. But, you know, from what I know about it and from the snippets I've managed to see, it sort of feels like it should almost be like a gallery installation.
Yeah.
You know,
video art, you know?
Yeah, it's like background noise.
Through different spaces and experience it that way rather than just sitting down and watching it.
R-rated background noise for your eyeballs.
But I don't know. At the same time, like, despite all this narrative experimentation and what some might call pretension, I still really connected like with the story and with this character. You know, I think what all that Schrader tried to do in the movie still makes you understand, get into this person's mind. It might not be a place that you enjoy, but
well, it is still a Paul Schrader movie. Again, we get back to that whole seedy, very seedy.
There's a lot of seeds in this.
But yeah, I'd recommend it for the more adventurous viewers out there. You might get a kick out of it. I did.
Who's doing coke in the background?
I have.
I think that's true.
Oh. Sorry.
My drug habits are not on trial here, sir.
Of course, we're the Paul Schrader cast, and you have the flu.
All right.
Okay. Sure, he does.
But I can't stress enough the contribution, though, of Schrader's DP John Bailey, who also shot Cat People and Forevermind. And he's got a very strong eye and sense of color and stuff. That movie, Mishima, looks amazing.
It does. It definitely does.
When they did the reissue for Criterion, didn't they do some like digital sort of juicing up of some of the sort of skies and things? I seem to remember reading something about that.
I couldn't tell you.
You should be able to.
All right. Getting on to our bads. And once again, to clarify, the bad is not necessarily a bad movie. It's just a flawed movie or a movie that we like for the wrong reasons. And let's start with Mercer.
Did John get to do a good?
He did Affliction.
Oh, okay. All right. I missed that.
But then I talked over him.
I was opening my bottle of wine at that point.
Which on a Paul Schrader podcast, Andrew, I don't mind at all.
I just realized that my bottle of wine is almost empty, and I've been drinking it right from the bottle.
You Philistine.
All right, John, what's your bad?
My bad is a little-known Schrader movie from the late 80s called Light of Day.
Not so little known as Adam Resurrected.
It's September 2009, by the way.
I don't know. The only way I could watch Light of Day was on YouTube.
There you go. I found a site that had a questionable mega upload style download of it.
Legit.
And now I have all sorts of porn pop-ups on my computer.
Yeah, like you didn't have those already.
I need you to fix my laptop, Steve. So with Light of Day, Paul Schrader essentially directs the lyrics of a Corey Hart ballad.
That joke that only Canadians will get. And Dan Mancini.
You know, kids have big dreams but are anchored by reality and responsibilities, which suck. My microphone was up. It starts out interestingly enough with the idea that through music, the Raznick siblings, played by Michael J. Fox and Joan Jett.
With radically different accents.
With radically different accents. One from suburban Ontario and the other from wherever the fuck Joan Jett is from. They can transcend their mundane, beat-down dog existence, even if just for a couple of hours when they're on stage. But then, of course, you know, that's not enough for a movie. So the family squabbling and the heavy-handed religious overtones.
Rock and roll is the devil's music.
Drop onto the movie like a goddamn anvil.
Does John Lithgow play the dad?
No, Gina Rowlands plays the mom.
It should have been John Lithgow.
Yeah. And the movie came out during a brief period in the late 80s when Michael J. Fox was kind of struggling to break free of his comedy sensation, beloved sitcom star mold. Mm-hmm. And he was actually turning out some pretty snappy work. I think this came out the same year as Casualties of War.
Casualties of War was awesome.
Yeah. For a second, I was like, when has Michael J. Fox not struggled to break out of that? But I see what you're saying.
Yeah. And then you got Joan Jett, on the other hand, is like Two-Face. her singing voice is as stellar as ever, but then she spends the rest of the movie sounding like she's reading from cue cards.
Mm-hmm.
This is why rock stars should never act.
Yeah, the subplots are... You shut up. Lee Ving was awesome in Streets of Fire.
There are some exceptions to that rule.
He was also awesome in Clue.
Roger Daltrey deserved that Oscar.
Bob Dylan in Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid.
Was awesome in Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid.
Bob's pretty good when he's shown up.
Bowie, of course.
Oh, yeah, Bowie.
Iggy Pop, but the Grove City of Angels.
But Joan Jett is not David Bowie.
No.
And, The subplots are weak, weak, weak sauce. And the movie never really manages to gain any momentum besides its cool first half of a first act.
And then the last act seems to come out from another movie entirely with the cancer and stuff.
Yeah, and then there's the whole, you know...
I forgot about the cancer.
And then there's the whole mystery of who got Peggy Preggers. And or whatever her his sister's name is.
Could I also point out that Michael Rooker should never play a character called Oogie?
Oogie.
But point out that Michael Rooker should only play characters named
Oogie. But only if they beat you with, you know, like monkey wrenches and things.
Oogie Burns, NASCAR driver. Oogie, portrait of a serial killer.
I would love to watch Oogie, portrait of a serial killer.
But, with all the trouble I had finding Light of Day, I was really hoping this was going to be a lost slice of 80s gold.
No.
No.
there's a reason.
So it's not Streets of Fire 2.
Yeah, there's a reason. It's not even Eddie and the Cruisers Part 2. there's a reason Light of Day has been forgotten.
Michael J. Fox does not project, like, you know, really, like, hard-edged rocker.
You look at it. Okay, look at the screenplay and everything. Basically, he was writing young Bruce Springsteen.
Mm-hmm.
Even the movie title comes from Springsteen lyrics.
Actually, I think from what I read is that they wanted to call it Born of the in the USA, but Springsteen liked that title so much that he took Born in the USA. And Light of Day is the title song that was written by Springsteen and sung by Joan Jett in the movie.
Okay.
It was an okay song.
Fun fact, Streets of Fire is also named after a Bruce Springsteen song.
But they actually got to use that title.
I don't know. My favorite Michael J. Fox movies are movies where he falls down while trying to put on underpants.
Yeah. I mean,
he's great at doing that.
Yeah, he's really good at it.
The only interesting thing I found about Light of Day is it's one of those rare movies that tries to show like the struggling band on the road going from small venue to small venue and just trying to make a living.
That's the stuff I liked.
Yeah.
You know, their existence is shit. Heard blue collar, but then, you know, they're on stage and the way it's shot when they're on stage and that, right, where you get like all you can see is just the light and everything. You know, for a few minutes they're in heaven. But then, I mean, then you just get, again, all the Calvinist shit with their mother.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole Schrader is really, really bad at mysteries.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, who got his sister pregnant? Oh, it was him. You know, he got this guy in the background who's basically been twirling his mustache the entire time. I like to get teenage girls pregnant. candy ass.
The old date on the railroad tracks.
But one thing that impressed me though in the last third with the mom's cancer is the way that he shot those scenes in the hospital, where like most directors would go overboard with music and stuff. It was like simple close up shots of her and Joan Jett talking. It would have been much better with a better actress, but still, I thought that wasn't too overplayed.
Well, shit, man, 5 years earlier, Paul Schrader would have had a whole ton of Giorgio Moroder.
All right, who wants to go next?
I'll go.
Go.
Because I love my own voice. My bad is relatively recent. It's The Walker, which got a few positive notices when it came out in 2007. And it starred Woody Harrelson as a Washington D.C. Sort of non-sexual escort for society ladies. He's a very obviously gay guy who, you know, politicians are perfectly comfortable having hang around their wives when they're looking to kill time. So he plays a lot of canasta. And take some shopping and, you know, of course he's gay, so he picks out their fabrics. And, you know, it's a really strange movie, I mean, the good thing is it's shot really, really well. It's a beautiful looking movie. It feels very much like the best of 80s sort of urban neon and more restrained synth scores. Like it feels a lot like an 80s movie, especially in Woody Harrelson's character's apartment, which is you can see Paul Schrader's obsession with Japanese culture again in this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it feels like it's a super luxurious dojo almost. It's you know, all these immaculately lacquered surfaces and drawers, and you know, he's wearing these brightly colored kimonos, and it's a really the best parts of the movie, I think, are in that space when he's sort of on his own. What Harrelson's character, I should probably get into a bit more detail. I mean, he's this escort. He gets mixed up in a scandalous situation with one of his female charges, played by Kristen Scott Thomas. He drives her to meet up with her boyfriend on the side, who she discovers murdered. And she can't, you know, reveal this to the police because it will destroy her husband's political career. So Woody Harrelson sort of he drives her home, then he comes back and he, you know, attempts to discover the body and calls the police, and as a result gets sort of pulled to all the messiness that entails, including I can't remember if he's the DA or he's sort of the federal attorney who's investigating the thing, and he knew Woody Harrelson when he was younger, and he sort of has resentment, and he's a bit of a homophobe, and he's basically like, Woody Harrelson is everything he hates about DC culture, and he kind of wants to knock him down a peg. Now there, you know, it's aesthetically, it's a pleasing movie. You can kind of trick your brain into going along with the mystery as he tries to figure out who killed this guy and who really has it out for him and stuff. But Schrader, as was just mentioned, handles mysteries really badly. And he handles it really badly.
He does.
It's a really muddled sort of combination of, you know, studying the social dynamics of this kind of environment along with really cheap, obvious shots of a, you know, ragingly liberal filmmaker against the Bush administration. Like, they're just random references to Iraq for no reason. As a raging liberal myself, there's, you know, I just spare me from my own allies. Like, I hate really lazy sort of.
Are you saying that the war in Iraq is just, Andrew?
That's what I'm saying. I'm saying it was fully justified. And I George W. Bush, way to go.
Oh my God, like, stop!
It's just like, there's no point to all these little political asides that are made. The biggest problem with the movie, I think, is Woody Harrelson's character. There's nothing wrong with the performance. He plays it, you know, it's a great performance on his part. Woody Harrelson's the best thing about the movie. If you ever had doubts that he was a really good actor, this is probably a good movie to look at. But unfortunately, Schrader writes and directs the character. I think I described it earlier to Gabriel as like it's a gay character out of a 70s musical. You know,
if you had to rate his fabulousness on a scale from 1 to 10.
I am going to have to go with amazing. Like, he's this like preening, immaculate, sort of made up dandy with daddy issues. He's from Virginia, so he's got that kind of like
he's got that Woody Harrelson accent.
Well, it's like Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil kind of like camp Southern like witticisms.
Woody Harrelson's accent, man, normally just sounds like he's got steak in his mouth.
Yeah. And, you know, normally is like good old boy. And this is definitely not. This is like, bring me my eighth mint julep. It's it's really problematic.
They want to sing for me. I'll sing for them.
But at the same, it's so weird though, because he plays it so well, and he doesn't play it in an offensive way. Like, he doesn't play it condescending to this stereotype. You know, he plays it as a very genuine character who has very genuine sort of problems and suffers for various reasons. And there's the relationship between he and his boyfriend is actually kind of, you know, it's kind of touching. Like, you want to see their relationship succeed. But it's just sort of constructed of these really outdated cliches. But it's all worth it for the scene where Woody Harrelson carefully takes his toupee off and reveals his bald, bald head and puts his toupee, which is like this sort of like immaculately sculpted William Shatner scalp, a little holder. It's a touching scene. But yeah, it's problematic. And the resolution of the mystery is just, it's, if you know what's going on, you'll have lots of questions. But it's more likely that you won't have any idea. It's just very muddled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Steve, what's your bet?
I was tempted to go with autofocus just because that was originally my good, and then I remembered Adam Resurrected. But I can't really consider autofocus a bad. Like, I would have said bad just because I wanted to talk about autofocus. But it's not a bad flick. It's a pretty good movie.
So, Greg Kinnear was the shit in autofocus.
Greg Kinnear, Greg Kinnear was amazing in autofocus. Willem Dafoe was pretty damn good in autofocus. Pretty much all of I can't really say much bad about autofocus, as unpleasant as the movie was. So I'm going to go with Dominion, the prequel to The Exorcist.
Yay!
Which, I'll be honest, I actually kind of liked.
Yeah, me too.
I just hear Gabe clinking glasses with himself.
No, that was me. We're in the same room.
I thought he was like, cheers, clink.
That was a virtual clink. No, I am going to go.
They've got an app for that.
Sure they do.
I just, Dominion, it was one of those movies that I think kind of got really caught up in the fact, like the bad hype for starters, and just the fact that it was, you know, hyped as a, you know, The Exorcist prequel kind of thing. So everybody immediately, anytime anybody touches anything having to do with The Exorcist, when you get a movie so iconic, of course everybody's going to knee-jerk and immediately, like, you know, if the movie isn't at least, you know, 9/10 as good as the original, then they're going to rebel against it in classic fashion. You know, and I mean, Gabe, you mentioned The Exorcist 3 earlier. The Exorcist 3 was a pretty damn creepy movie, you know?
Yeah.
But it was just, it wasn't The Exorcist, so of course everybody, oh, it sucks. You know,
and like,
I don't say it sucks, like, but it's pretty darn flawed.
And just like Dominion, it's very talky.
Yeah, it is talky. It is. And like, what I liked about Dominion is it was the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And after, like, you know, I had seen Harlan's version first, of course, and then sat down and watched Dominion when they released, when I picked up the box set, like the full collection of the Exorcist movies or whatever for really, really cheap. And Dominion happened to be included, and I was like, oh, hell, I hadn't even realized that it was released. And sat down and took a look, and I was like, man, I quite enjoyed that movie. You know, I thought I thought the atmosphere was pretty effective. I thought it was effectively creepy when it wanted to be. Performances were pretty good all around, and it was a great-looking movie. You know, it looked really sharp.
And of course, Schrader being Schrader, it goes deeper into psychology of the main character than the Alien movie does.
Yeah, big time. it's a really great experiment to sit down and watch that one and then watch the Harlan version and see just how completely different the two versions of the same movie can be, you know? But it's, I gotta say, like, as far as, you know, a sequel to The Exorcist, which, I mean, you know, has been pretty maligned, I mean, it's probably a movie that never should have been touched, but as far as the sequels go, I think Dominion is probably the best of them by far, you know, and that's, I mean, no, it's not saying a whole lot, but, you know, it's saying something. the only drag is it drags.
Yeah.
You know, it is kind of a slow movie. It isn't. I mean, now the original Exorcist wasn't a mile a minute by any stretch, and I think Schrader actually came the closest to really nailing that atmosphere of the original movie, like to really nailing that same vibe. But it wasn't as shocking as The Exorcist was. You know, it didn't have that same... But you couldn't really do that and get away with it anyway. You couldn't really... You know, once The Exorcist did it, it was done. That door was open. You know what I mean?
But what really floored me was like that there's basically a repeat of the scene that haunts Stellan Skarsgård with the guy shooting the little girl.
Yeah, yeah.
That was really rough.
You know, that's the only aspect of the movie that I enjoyed. The problem I have with Dominion is I did not find the exploration of the nature of evil very compelling at all. In the way that Schrader did it, I thought it was interesting to have that kind of haunted background, and I just found the rest of the movie incredibly dull and so talky.
And that's why it's a bad and not a good. You know, like it is a slow moving movie. It is a kind of. But I think the thing with it's one of those movies. It's a prime example of like I can't even pick a title off the top of my head at the moment. But you know, you watch those movies where you've got. You know, a really slow burn, and you're just kind of like, where is this going? Where is this going? Where is this going? And then the end game hits, that final act hits, and everything starts to fall into place. Then when the movie's over, you're like, holy shit, that was awesome. You know, like, now Dominion, there's no holy shit, that was awesome with Dominion, but there are elements of that movie that really stand out, and there's stuff that really kind of grabs you, I find, and I can kind of get past the slowness of it, you know, and I can kind of get past the dull aspects of the movie because the other stuff worked so well for me. You know what I mean?
And like the to have the like kind of racial tension too, like that adds to it. I find, you know, that I thought that was a smart decision.
Can I just say I really hate Gabriel Mann? Between that and Don't Come Knocking, that Wim Wenders movie. Oh God. I never want to see him in anything again.
I see you watched a Wim Wenders movie, so it's your own stupid fault.
Hey,
Gabriel's gonna kill you.
Yeah, of course. Wings of Desire is amazing.
I agree. I love Wings of Desire.
I vehemently disagree.
But I can totally see why Steve would not.
Yeah. And I mean, there's one line that I take away from Dominion, and at one point, Gabriel Mann's character tells Stellan Skarsgård
in monotone.
He's like, "All we have left is prayer," and then Skarsgård replies, "That's like having nothing, isn't it?"
Yeah, yeah.
I agree.
All right. For my bad, I also went with a slow burn that's a bit too much of a slow burn, and that is the movie Light Sleeper.
You mean Heavy Sleeper?
Yeah.
Zing. I mean,
it's another, Schrader calls them Men in a Room movies, and he puts like Taxi Driver, American Gigolo, Light Sleeper, and The Walker all in that same category where you have like this fully formed character that you don't really know where he's coming from, and you know, it just appears and then you get into kind of his headspace, but it takes too much time for you to get into the headspace of the foe. There's like 30 minutes of nothing going on, and he like basically this is a guy who has nothing in life and he's just waiting for something to happen, and of course something terrible happens to him to shake up his life, and like the last two thirds or so of the movie were really compelling, but that beginning is a slog to get through. And I mean, Willem Dafoe is really great in it. It's nice to see Susan Sarandon kind of she's playing a different kind of character for her because she's like the drug she's running the drug trade, and Willem Dafoe is like your dealer.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's like a major plot. I'll reveal it because I know nobody else will watch this movie. basically, Dafoe meets up with his old girlfriend who he used to do drugs with, and she's now clean, and he's telling her that he's now clean and stuff like that. But then, like, her mom died or something, and then she goes back on the coke and throws herself off the building and dies. And that's what it takes to like, shake him off of his, like, uselessness and re-examine his life again. But until that point, like, that moment really made me go, oh, shit, I have to keep watching now. But before then, I was almost ready to like, quit the movie because I'm like, well, nothing's going on here. It's just this guy doing his drugs and, like, having conflicts with Susan Sarandon because she wants to quit the life and start, like, a cosmetics business or something. I'm like,
oh.
But once again, like with the American Gigolo, the ending is really good and basically cribbed from Robert Bresson's Pickpocket.
Mm-hmm.
I think I might have seen this movie. I think I did.
But I'm like, it's the very definition for me of a bad. It's a movie that with a few changes could be something really good, but just doesn't really work as is.
Doesn't it end with, like, one of the most, I can't say inappropriate, but most, like, out of place shootouts?
No.
Ever? A shootout just kind of come out of nowhere, and you're watching the entire movie, and you're like, okay, where the fuck did this violence come from?
Well, yeah, basically, it's because some guys they were dealing drugs with was doing some criminal stuff. He had murdered people, and they were, like, onto him, and then they get into the apartment, and he wants to kill them, but... Yeah, there's like a big shootout that's basically it's shot kind of Pekinpa style.
Yeah. This is the one I'm thinking of.
Mm-hmm.
I just brought up the Wikipedia page. There, that's the one. I remember seeing this on video and being like, "Wait a minute, what?" Oh,
I haven't seen it, but if I had, I'd probably say something hilarious.
How about you, John? Are you still alive?
No.
Well, get ready, John. We're getting to your favorite part of this podcast.
I've been watching Schrader movies and sleeping the sleep of the dead.
And
you're like God's lonely man.
We're going to tackle The Uglies, our least favorite movie.
Ooh, me first.
By Paul Schrader. Go, Andrew!
Okay. Let me set the stage. You're in, say, let's say it's 2002. You rent a video from Blockbuster. You put it in, you sit down, and the words "coming soon" from Dimension Home Video pop up.
Oh no!
Okay, my movie is exactly what you would expect from what would follow those words.
From Dimension Home Video.
Yeah, I don't know if it was released by Dimension, but this is exactly the kind of movie that should have, you know, DVD home video plastered all over it. And, like, special features, interactive menu. It is Paul Schrader's attempt to do a sort of neo-noir movie.
I know where this is going.
He has taken the most sort of hackneyed story elements he could possibly gather from 60 years of film noir, combined it with an embarrassingly melodramatic romance.
Mm-hmm.
It is, okay, take all the noir setups where you have sort of like a lowly guy getting involved with a rich man's wife. But then take away all the stuff about, you know, them actually being conflicted, dark individuals, and just make it into, like, Romeo and Juliet. And then instead of having the guy, the big mean guy be, you know, dark and abusive or somehow interesting in some way, he's just kind of, like, kind of a frickin' businessman.
This sounds awesome!
Okay. So basically what happens is...
Let's just say the title is Forevermind.
Forevermind. I mean, Joseph Fiennes plays a cabana boy. He sees Gretchen Mol come out of the ocean in, like, true Honey Rider style. She apparently blows him away by looking kind of ordinary. Walks up and orders a water from him. He's instantly smitten. He's completely distracted from his stereotypical Latino friend who's talking about, you know, running drugs from the Keys because, you know, being a Latino guy, that's all he knows. He just wants to deal drugs. Can't we deal drugs, Joseph Fiennes? No, Latino friend. We can't deal drugs. We're cabana boys. So, you know, he gets involved and she doesn't want to get involved because her husband's very possessive. And then they fall into this really, so I mean, aside from the fact that obviously Schrader made this movie as an excuse for Gretchen Mol to take her top off, yes. Otherwise sort of very innocent kind of virginal romance.
Does he ever really need any other excuse than...
No, not really. At least there's that. But basically, you know, they get involved, she has to leave, he follows her to New York... Ray Liotta is kind of like, oh, this irritates me. So he sends some guys to shoot him in the face with a shotgun, which doesn't go quite as well as he'd hoped because Joseph Fiennes throws his hand up in front of his face, which deflects it and does sort of this two-phase burned effect. He goes away for 14 years. A lot of the movie is flashbacks on a plane of Joseph Fiennes as Manuel Esquema, his new identity that he's built up over 14 years. Sort of this South American or Miami, like, drug lord, maybe kind of ish character. I mean, that's kind of the best way to envision him with the two-face thing going on. But aside from the fact that he's two-face, he actually looks exactly the same because, you know, if you look closely, yes, he's got scarring, but it doesn't actually change his face in any dramatic way. So when he comes back into their life and nobody recognizes him, it's really hard to take. He then proceeds on the dumbest revenge scheme you can possibly imagine. I mean, it's dumb both from the perspective of the guy who's doing it, the character, and it's dumb from a screenwriting perspective. It makes absolutely no sense. It essentially relies on Joseph Fiennes in the intervening 14 years going from a cabana boy to some kind of financial mastermind who can access like offshore accounts and all this information from nowhere. While simultaneously needing to con Ray Liotta out of all his money. So somehow he's, you know, incredibly successful and knowledgeable and also still completely poor. His cabana boy friend, for some reason, comes along with him, on this vendetta thing, maybe. Basically, you know, Josephine's character does the dumbest things. Every decision he can make, he makes the dumbest decision. But not in a way that makes the movie really interesting. It's just still really boring. The score is by Angelo Badalamenti, who's done some really good stuff for David Lynch. But here, you know, it's still that kind of super melodramatic, syrupy sort of romance synth stuff. But since it's not against the weirdness of David Lynch, it just plays on that surface level of being really syrupy, melodramatic, romancey stuff.
And basically, it's like an Harlequin novel.
It's so embarrassing. It is. Joseph Fiennes gives a terrible performance.
Oh, he's bad.
Gretchen Mol, you know, at least she's really bland, but at least she's competent. Joseph Fiennes is just awful. Ray Liotta is, you know, he kind of doesn't make an impression. He's playing his stock direct-to-video Ray Liotta character. Dialed down a few levels. He's not really... There's one line, though, that really gets the truth of it, and that's when they're sitting in prison, and Joseph Fiennes is going off on this sort of, like, romantic thing about how he has to be with Ray Liotta's wife and this and that, and it's all destiny. And Ray Liotta says, like, makes sense, nobody talks like this. And I was thinking, yes, nobody talks like this. That's the problem with this movie. it's, you know, portraying this like super romantic cabana boy who's just completely ridiculous as some kind of hero. It's awful. It is so awful.
I couldn't make it past what, 30 or 40 minutes in the flick. I shut it off after like he follows her to New York and she shows up in the hotel room and he's written "Love is all" on the wall and I'm like, barf.
Or give all to love.
Yeah, give all to love.
And see, that would be the point where I would have said, why the hell did I pick Paul Schrader?
it's everything trite about film noir and nothing that makes film noir interesting. Like, it takes all of the psychological elements out and replaces them with idiocy.
It's got something in common with My Ugly, which I'll get to later, and it's a movie that's totally unfit for Paul Schrader. Like, it's a subject matter that he should never have touched.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm going to go drown my sorrows in medical alcohol.
All right. Who goes into the lower depths next?
John?
Yeah.
Rip that Band-Aid off.
Just give me a second. I need to drink this glass of wine. This full glass of wine.
If the word goblet applies, use the word.
While John is drinking his glass of wine.
This magnum of champagne.
While he's drinking his magnum of champagne, I'm going to chime in. I'm going to keep this very, very brief. For those of you who have seen the New York Times article about the canyons, don't. just don't. Do not, under any circumstances. Like, don't. I don't want to elaborate. I will just, like, you know, I'm not going to go off on a half-hour diatribe about this movie. I'm not going to, you know, tell you all of the individual little specifics. I will say that the lead actor and actress are absolutely terrible. Like, really, really terrible. Go find the article. Read. You'll know who it is. I'm not going to throw any more fuel on that fire. But, yeah, it's pretty much absolutely abhorrent in every way, shape, or form. It makes me question not only Paul Schrader's sanity, but it makes me question the entire human race. Like, it just... I can't even begin to explain how fucking awful this movie is.
Okay. On a scale of 1 to 10, if you had to rate Gus Van Sant's fabulousness in this movie...
Yeah.
What would you go with?
I can't even go there. I can't.
Like, are we just talking like mildly fabulous, or is he like total woo-hoo fabulous?
Woo-hoo! No, it's
how was Jersey Boys?
I just, man, like, I would rather sit down and watch. I can't even.
Don't say a Gus Van Sant movie.
I would listen to Fred Treasure for 8 hours.
I would sit down and watch Fred the movie 6 times before I would sit down and watch The Canyons again.
Oh,
you know, this is how deplorably awful this movie is. This movie is a waste of existence. It is just, you know, Steven Soderbergh going on about how amazing the sex scene is, isn't it? You know what? Soderbergh, bite me, okay? Because you're just, no. No.
It's like a hope vacuum.
No brightness exists in this place. It is a dark place. It is unholy.
Not even light can escape it.
No, like Forever Mine is Citizen Kane next to this movie.
At least Forever Mine had a Two-Face character named whatever it was.
At least Forever Mine had a cabana boy.
a cabana boy who totally wasn't the Count of Monte Cristo.
Yeah. You know, it was, man, wow. Like, wow. Absolutely. I mean, if you've seen the trailers, you know exactly what to expect, and that is refuse of the highest caliber.
Poop.
Yeah,
which trailer? The really lame Grindhouse trailer? The 50s?
That one was, yeah, no. That was even, might have been a little bit of an improvement. But no, it was just, man, like, I cannot even begin to tell you how mind-numbingly awful this movie is. On the plus side, it's short. You know, you'll only lose about an hour and a half of your life, maybe. I think it might even be a little less then, but, you know, it was, oh my god.
on like forever runtime.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry, Andrew. I had to steal that shit because that was cool.
You're welcome to steal it.
Absolute mindless waste of existence. And I'm done. I got nothing more to say about Paul Schrader.
All right, John, are you ready?
And my magnum of champagne is finished. Excellent. You're okay, fueled. My bad.
You're ugly.
You're hate you.
Or my ugly, sorry. My ugly. 1982's Cat People.
Yep.
Sweet, adorable Jesus. No amount of naked Natasha Kinski is worth this Faustian deal with the bizarro erotic devil.
So what is it, a movie about furries?
No. I would have watched a movie about furries. Rather than shit.
I will say this. I like the opening credits.
Paul Schrader. Yeah, that's...
That's all.
Paul Schrader has gone on record in interviews, new and old, and states that he doesn't understand the horror genre. No shit, Paul. I've seen Cat People. He cooks up impressive atmosphere, but it's not an interesting or even a good movie. It's not unlike Tony Scott's The Hunger in that regard, only The Hunger had more than a handful of redeeming qualities.
Is this the one where you got like the mother and the son who are actually cats and he drives around in a bitch in Trans Am? Is that one?
No, that's Sleepwalkers.
Oh, okay. All right. Sorry. My bad.
No, this one is about Malcolm McDowell.
This one could really use a Trans Am.
And wasn't it the Borg Queen in Sleepwalkers?
Is that Alice Krieger?
Yeah. Creepy bitch from Silent Hill.
No.
But anyway, I put the movie in. I want to like it, but it's just there's always something that keeps pulling my attention away.
You didn't want to like it.
No, I'm not. Is Natasha Kinski bringing a childlike innocence to our arena, or is she just a bad actress?
B.
Is Malcolm McDowell wonderfully creepy or cheesy and overdone?
B.
Could Giorgio Moroder's score possibly make this any more painful? He out-bombs Inception. It's like he was playing it on the keyboard in 1982, and he keeps having a stroke and leaning on a heavy key.
It's like the Don Cherry piano desk.
The following year, he toned it way down for Scarface.
Wow.
Yeah, okay, listen. You guys have seen Midnight Express, obviously. The chase is... that's, like, way withdrawn compared to Cat People.
Oh, Cat People.
The movie is desperately trying to be an artistic, intellectual fantasy horror. But it's just such a pile of shit.
But Natasha Kinski was so awesome in Terminal Velocity.
That brings a smile to my face because I get to mention Ditch Brody again.
Ditch Brody.
Greatest hero name ever.
Like, okay, you know those movies where it feels like the movie puts you in a coma? I felt like when I turned this off, it was like waking up from a coma.
When William Hurt goes in the tank in Altered States, this is the shit he sees.
I love the tagline, an erotic fantasy about the animal in us all.
Can I just say that the original Val Lewton, Jacques Tourneur, Cat People, I love that movie.
That movie is awesome.
It's a great movie. But
that's actually a horror movie.
I like the version of Cat People that's about an alcoholic cowboy. Wait, that was Cat Ballou, sorry.
Wait a minute, how did you pronounce that?
Cat Bau or Balu, Balu, whatever.
Wait, say it again. Say chowder.
Bare necessities.
Balu, whatever.
Man.
Oh, Cat People.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. Like, when did we think Malcolm McDowell was a good actor?
Back in 76.
Look what you did. Just look what you did.
In 72, he was pretty good, even though that movie's overrated. I actually have liked him in stuff, but generally, he's Cat People Malcolm McDowell, which is mega ham.
Yeah. He's like, he's on the same end of the scale as Tim Curry and Ben Kingsley.
He's actually tastes like maple if you lick him. That kind of a smokiness.
You've met Malcolm McDowell, haven't you? Does he taste like maple?
Oh, man.
Go ahead, Gabriel. It's all right. You can lick me. I found a place where the predator has no fangs.
We're having way too much fun. I need to bring this down again with my ugly.
Yes, and do that it.
That is the movie Touch.
I think, John, were you just describing a vagina? Because that's what I interpreted that phrase.
But that's all that fucking Cronenberg, man. You gotta stop. I'm staging an intervention. I miss the old Andrew.
Okay, all right. I'm going to talk about Touch here. Very
There's
briefly.
Nothing good Do about we have to?
All you need to know about Touch is Skeet Ulrich, Tom Arnold.
Tom Arnold?
Gina Gershon.
Yeah.
Ooh.
This is like, if you were to tell me a Paul Schrader film from an Elmore Leonard script or novel, I would never have guessed you would get Touch.
But then you have to factor in that it's a comedy about the guy with stigmata.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Oh, right, wow. There.
Guys, remind me again why I ever liked Elmore Leonard. Oh, right. Get Shorty.
Rum Punch.
Yeah.
Jackie Brown.
Well, Out of Sight was pretty awesome, too.
Apparently, from what I read, is that Schrader actually wanted to adapt Rum Punch, but that was picked up, of course, by Tarantino. So he said,
hey, Skeet, what you doing?
Oh, Touch.
Who was it who described Skeet Ulrich as, like, every single waiter in Greenwich Village or something?
No, Skeet Ulrich, like, if Ethan Hawke and Johnny Depp had a baby together, it would be Skeet Ulrich.
That's terrifying.
I mean, Paul Schrader doing comedy? Really? No.
I think Paul, like, you could take that thing about that admission that he doesn't understand the horror genre, it's scratch out horror and just put an underline and make it like a single sentence Mad Libs.
Paul Schrader doesn't understand fucking oxygen, okay?
Well, this is the type of guy where David Lynch is like, whoa, fuck off, dude. Stop being such a weirdo. But seriously, man, it's my birthday. Stop being weird.
I mean, for me, I think Schrader, like, originally, especially in his first few movies, I mean, he really had an eye in his sense for atmosphere and, like, he knew what it was like to make a movie, but then he went, like, from the 90s on, he forgot everything he knew about making movies.
As long as we're doing sort of like our summation opinion of Paul Schrader, I think, you know,
let's do that.
He does. I think he's talented. I think he has a style, and, you know, when he's able to sort of harness it well, you can get some. I think all his movies are flawed that I've seen, but I think, like, you know, he's done some almost successful stuff, and I think he has it in him. But he's much better to me as a writer and not directing his own stuff. I love the Yakuza. If you want to see an awesome, awesome crime movie about a guy going to Japan with an amazing katana fight at the end,
you need to watch Black Rain. I mean, what? Sorry.
No, watch the Yakuza.
Watch The Hunted with Christopher Lambert.
Raging Bull, obviously, is really good. Bringing Out the Dead is amazing. Taxi Driver, obviously, is amazing.
I am
a temptation.
I have a guilty thing to admit.
What's that?
I am not a fan of Taxi Driver at all.
Oh. I don't enjoy it.
I just don't like it. I think
It's one of those movies that I appreciate and just don't.
I don't even really appreciate it.
You guys might You guys want me to walk out right now. Is that what you're doing?
Oh, stalks a 12-year-old and then shoot somebody. Okay, great.
But I love Bringing Out the Dead.
I do, too. Yeah. I do, too. Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Bringing Out the Dead. Even though all my friends hate it.
Fuck you, man. I love
it.
I still love Cliff Curtis, man, in that movie.
Yeah.
My summation on Schrader, overrated in general. Like, you know, as a writer, I consider him a little overrated. And as a director, well, I mean, he's not really rated very highly as a director to begin with, but I just consider him to be, you know, he like everybody else who's done more than, you know, four movies, he's got a few that are worth watching. But, you know, like, I mean, for me, he's no Argento, you know, where I'm like, ah! But for the most part, outside of really two or three movies, I can't handle him. I find
a little too often he's managed to pass off unpleasantness as insight.
And beyond that, he's managed,
complexity.
He's managed to garner this reputation as like an artiste or an avant-garde, and he's not really. He's experimentalist for sure. And I mean, yeah, okay, fine, be an experimentalist. That's great, you know, but, you know, don't mistake lack of talent for genius. You know?
Poor Gabe. We still like you.
What's the other big quote? Art is just tolerated vandalism. He is the vandal.
Like, you know? I mean, at this point, the only movies I haven't seen are the three last ones, and besides Forever Mind and Touch, I have enjoyed all of them to some degree. But then I'm just fucked up.
like Paul Schrader's film career to me feels like a side effect of Martin Scorsese kicking him out of his pool house.
That it? Yeah. That is it.
He was Martin Scorsese's cabana boy?
Yeah, he was Martin Scorsese's Cato Kaelin. And then just...
But seriously, watch The Yakuza. Oh, I love that movie.
I think I've seen The Yakuza, actually.
Oh, man, it's got 10... Ken Takakura in it.
Yeah, and he is amazing in it.
That's the guy who played Moss in Black Rain,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I have.
Wow, that guy was old.
I have seen the Yakuza.
But yeah, another thing that we could say about Schrader is that his approach to movies is definitely more intellectual than it is, you know, emotional.
Oh, for sure.
He does definitely like to get into psychology. You know, he does definitely like to get into the psychology of his characters.
And that's probably why I like it.
I feel like he's a robot trying to understand these human emotions.
Exactly, and that's the problem I have with him. Like, you know, he tries to get into this psychology and stuff, but he doesn't quite understand it himself. And he doesn't quite have the chops to be ambiguous enough so that, like, you know, rather than... You know, try to dig deep and uncover this psychology, you know, rather than leave it ambiguous so that people can draw their own conclusions. It's like he's trying to make a point, but he can't quite make it.
Yeah, he's not Cronenberg.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Vaginas?
Shut up!
Steve, who do we have on the line for next week?
Coming up next week, we have a Canadian who is well-versed in kicking ass and taking names, at least. You know, I believe some crew wore a shirt that basically said, James Cameron is a hands-on director, and I have the bruises to prove it. So there you go. Next week we will be dropping the bomb on Jimmy C.
I will be wearing my USS Sulaco t-shirt.
I'll be wearing the Weyland-Yutani t-shirt, considering I'm a corporate stooge.
I'll be back.
I was going to say something, but I can't follow up on that.
Yeah.
All right. With that said, see you next Wednesday.